Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's not your imagination. There are more animals these days in public places, from grocery stores to airports to hospitals. For example, a University of California study found a 1,000% increase in animals registered with that state as therapy dogs or emotional support animals over a decade. And an airline trade group says the number of emotional support animals traveling on board rose almost 75% from 2016 to 2017. The increase is attributed in part to greater awareness of the help animals can provide with a range of mental and physical disabilities, but it's also due to some stretching of the definition of service animal and people using bogus certificates to look official. So now states and businesses are trying to find a middle ground between people who truly need an animal's help and those who don't. That's what we're tackling today in The Exchange, and let's hear your stories. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Randy Pierce, president of 2020 Vision Quest, which raises money for services for the blind, including guide dog training. Randy lost his sight at age 22. Today, he's a motivational speaker, achieving athletic feats, including hiking all of New Hampshire's 4,000 footers with his dog. And Randy, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
You're very welcome.
Also with us, Lindsay Hamrick. She's New Hampshire State Director for the Humane Society of the United States. She's also a certified professional dog trainer. And Lindsay, welcome back to The Exchange. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Sabrina Estabrook-Russett. She's a veterinarian and owner of Court Street Veterinary Hospital in Keene. And Sabrina, thank you for making the trip on this slippery day. We appreciate it.
Good morning. Thank you.
And in a few moments, we'll be also speaking with Lynn Clay, managing attorney at the Disability Rights Center of New Hampshire. Slippery roads out there this morning, so it's taking people a little while to get in. Well, all of you, I just want to start broad, and then we can get into some of the specific definitions out there these days. Emotional support animal, psychiatric service animal, and of course the more familiar term, service dog. But first, the why. And I think I'll turn to you first, Lindsay. Why do you think we are seeing more animals in public places these days? 10 years ago, you rarely saw a dog at the grocery store. Today, it's not uncommon.
I think people are recognizing the incredible bond that we have with animals of all kinds. And as pet owners are able to spend more time with their animals, they're going to take advantage of that. We're going to talk quite a bit this hour about all of the therapeutic benefits of having animals. But I think even for regular pet owners, just our ability to interact with them and to feel that non-judgmental love and compassion every day is such a huge part of our lives.
Tell us about the expanded roles that you see, Lindsay, animals playing. I mean, there's, you know, everybody's used to the idea of a seeing eye dog. But I've been reading about dogs who can sense when someone who has diabetes is about to have a crisis, who can sense when someone is about to have a seizure, sort of these lesser known or less obvious disabilities that animals, especially dogs, can help with.
We're learning so much about the ability for animals to detect whether it's medical or psychological challenges within us and to be able to alert us to those pieces. And, you know, we see dogs that are now alerting for autistic children and autistic adults to help them through behavioral challenges that they may be facing. And then, of course, when you're talking about the therapeutic benefits that come into under the realm of the emotional support animal, you know, you're talking about alleviating things like depression and anxiety and some of those challenges that folks have. And there's quite a bit of research now that's really backing up the ability for dogs or other types of species to be able to help us with all of those challenges.
Randy, what's your perspective on this?
So obviously I get a tremendous benefit right away being totally blind from what my guide dog does. And I have full respect and appreciation for how much these animals can do for us. And that's not just for me, but for all the various types of benefits they can bring. The challenge, obviously, is we have to figure out what's an appropriate benefit and what's an appropriate amount of training for proper integration with the rest of the world. And that's the part that's an important and an essential partnership with that training to help people.
Give us a little bit more on that. Proper training. I'm getting a sense from you that animals that are not properly trained, you find not helpful and maybe even harmful to your own situation.
So both it's the partnership. The team has to be properly trained, right? So the animal and the handler need to know how to have themselves integrate in the world in a better means to provide less distraction, less disruption of the business or the other patrons of any place they're attending. You know, one of the challenges, Autumn has gone through a lot of training, Autumn, my service dog, to make sure that she knows how to get out of the way. She's tucked under my chair here. People come in. She's not going to be a disruption. Now, some animals who may not have had that training may start making a disruption. And that's okay. Dogs are going to make some mistakes sometimes. And if that happens, how does the handler react? They train me. They train my dog so that we know how to do that. And we have to make sure that that proper training happens so that we can all integrate well with society.
I'd love your thoughts too, Sabrina, as a veterinarian. I'm sure you work with lots and lots of people who have different needs and relationships with their animals. What's your perspective on this issue? You know, you do see a lot more animals in public places these days. You do hear a lot of stories on social media about, you know, people bringing peacocks and pigs on airplanes.
Sure, sure. You know, and I think one of our issues with this whole, debate that's coming up is, you know, access to public spaces and which animals are utterly unsuitable to be, you know, a quote-unquote service animal or an emotional support animal, and which ones have gone through the proper training, just like Randy has discussed there. So, and to my knowledge, and Randy, you can correct me, there's no, at this point, federal oversight for any kind of training programs, licensing, you know, things of that nature. So really, there's no official hoops that we need to jump through in order to accommodate somebody saying that they do have a service animal.
Do people come to you, Sabrina, asking, could you please certify my, you know, dog or cat as an emotional support animal?
They do. We do get the question. And, you know, I, as a veterinarian, can only certify the health of the animal. So is it free from communicable diseases? Is it something that's going to transmit, you know, any kind of disease or mite or mange onto different animals? But I can't certify the behavior of an animal or the safety of an animal in public spaces, especially with other pets, children being involved as well. So when we talk about emotional support animals, that's a request and a certification process that has to go through a human doctor, you know, psychiatrist or therapist in order to have that signed off.
Well, that makes sense. You're trained to work with animals, and if someone needs an emotional support animal or feels they do, that's about them. That's not about the dog or the cat or whatever. So that's not your expertise, obviously.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. We want your stories, questions, comments about the rising use of animals in different types of therapies for different types of disabilities and some of the conflicts that come up about animals in public places. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. So lots of comments came in even before we went on the air. And Penny on Facebook says, please share how service animals are very different than emotional support animals and have great protections. Jen on Facebook says, focus on how a service animal should be trained and what the differences are between a service animal, therapy animal, and a pet. What can businesses legally ask for to ensure they are service animals and not someone saying it's a service dog to bring your pet into the store? So let's get some definitions out of the way. Thank you, Jen and Penny, for those comments. And all of you, maybe you first, Lindsay, how do you define a service animal? Is there an official sort of hardcore definition?
Yeah, I think that to try to simplify this as much as possible, and this is not a simple concept here, but service dogs, I think, are probably the best defined. That is an animal that's been trained to perform a specific task for somebody with a disability. And service animals are protected under the Americans for Disabilities Act. So there's some federal guidelines and laws that protect that relationship. Therapy dogs are sort of on the other end of the spectrum in terms of who they're benefiting. That's an agreement between a pet owner and an animal that the animal will then go to places like hospitals or nursing homes or work with children to try to provide that therapeutic benefit or comfort to a group of people or an individual.
Pre-approved, by the way. If someone's afraid of dogs, you probably don't want to bring a therapy pet into a nursing home.
Exactly. And even though therapy animals don't have any federal laws that are sort of overseeing that process, there's sort of checks and balances because those animals are going into such public spaces. So what we tend to see is therapy animals and service dogs are very well trained. They're appropriate animals to be in spaces with lots of strangers. The emotional support category, I think, is the category that creates the most debate. And the emotional support animal is really an animal that a doctor, as Sabrina has mentioned, that a doctor or therapist has said is providing therapeutic benefit to a pet owner. But that animal may or may not be appropriate to be out in public in all kinds of different situations. And from a legal perspective, the caveat is that emotional support animals are covered under the Fair Housing Act. And so those animals are allowed to be in apartments or rental homes that normally would be restricted from pets in general. And I think that's where we see the loophole sort of being exploited in some situations.
And to you, Lindsay, but also you, Randy, but Lindsay, go ahead, you first. What kind of time and training are involved in that first category that a lot of people are familiar with, you know, the official service animal?
Yeah, Randy certainly could speak to this better than I can, but it's at least an 18-month process.
Wow.
To really, depending on the service that the animal's providing. So you're seeing dogs who have been trained for well over a year working in public spaces, getting used to all the distractions and interactions with strangers that comes with that job.
18 months, that's a long time. Yeah, Randy, I'd love your thoughts on this too, please.
Sure, and I think Lindsay highlighted that it really depends on the type of service that it's providing. In the case of a guide dog, 18 months is absolutely the case. In fact, a little bit more than that is often involved. From puppy raising, where they're being exposed to all of this, being trained their obedience in all of those environments, and then formal guide training after that. So, but the challenge is really that there is no guideline for what is required in that training process. There is, as Sabrina said earlier, right, there is no federal stature that says this is how much training, this is what canine good citizenship is required, or any of that.
Really? Why is that?
Because no such laws have been passed.
Right. So it's kind of a judgment call as to the level of training and certification needed, Randy?
So absolutely, right? If you have it, what is required is you have to have the disability to have the need. And the animal has to perform a task that assists you in that. It has
gotcha.
To have an action that it's doing in that process.
So in your case, you certify or officially state that you can't see and your dog is providing an obvious service helping you get from A to B.
Sure. And in the case of most guide dogs, there are schools all over the country that do that certifying for us. But it's really the case. It's between me and my doctor that would have certified that. But I'm not allowed to be asked for that certification because you're trying to protect people's rights to privacy in regards to their health status, even though, right, the harness does have an identification on it.
Sure.
Right. What you can ask is something you mentioned and alluded to early in the program is what can someone in a business owner, as a business owner, say to someone who's carrying a service dog in with them or bringing a service dog? And those are very restricted questions to make sure that you are protecting the person as well as the business owner.
Go ahead, Sabrina. I can see you want to jump in.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's an interesting kind of concept. You mentioned the vest that the pup has over there. And I think that in and of itself it creates a whole sub-market online. So you can go on and buy these different harnesses and official-looking vests and patches. Really, they don't confer any kind of authority to these animals. I think good service animals, good therapy dogs tend to have the kind of organizations that they work with displayed. But it's not automatically something that, says that they're an official actual service animal. So
and as we've learned, there's been a proliferation of these, you know, fake certificates and patches and
yes.
vests and all that. Well, as we talk about what rights the individual has, what rights the individual organization or business might have, we're happy that Lynn Clay has made it in. Lynn, thank you so much. And Slippery Roads. So we really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Lynn is managing attorney at the Disability Rights Center of New Hampshire. And Lynn, what rights do people with disabilities have when it comes to entering a place, airplanes keep coming up, but there are other places, restaurants and stores and so forth. What rights do people have when they want to enter a public place with their animal?
Well, it depends. I think, as Randy was pointing out, there's very limited questions that can be asked of an individual with a disability who's entering with an animal. When we're talking about places of public accommodation like restaurants and hotels and stores, the questions are so limited, they can ask two questions. They can ask, is that a service animal and what service does it provide? And in the case of guide dogs, for example, if it's obvious to the business owner what service the dog is providing, they shouldn't be asking any questions. And it really shouldn't be any more intrusive than that. When you talk about airplanes, the difference with airplanes is that it's a different federal statute.
Wow.
Okay. So when we're talking about places like stores and restaurants and things like that, it's the Americans with Disabilities Act which controls. The difference is when we're talking about airplanes, the federal statute is the Air Carrier Access Act. And the Air Carrier Access Act allows for emotional support animals on planes, which is a significant distinction from the Americans with Disabilities Act, which only allows service animals.
Yeah, and I was surprised to learn that yesterday getting ready for the show. Why is that, Lynn? Especially given that, airplanes are confined spaces. You got a lot of people, and sometimes there's tensions that come up.
You know, it was a congressional decision based on the testimony that they received. They decided that they would make it a broader category.
Do you want to jump in, Lindsay?
Yeah, and I think if you imagine that an emotional support animal has a purpose in terms of a therapeutic benefit to the person, and when we're talking about flights, having that animal be with that person is probably one of the reasons they're able to get onto the flight to go where they're going. And so it's allowing people to utilize that animal in the way that they were intended, which is to be an emotional support animal through something that would otherwise be very challenging or fearful for them.
Yeah, although I do wonder, speaking of rights, Lynn, I have a cousin who is highly, highly, highly allergic to cats and dogs. So he travels actually a ton for work. So does he have rights to say, no, you can't have your therapy cat on the plane because I'm going to blow up?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And the Transportation Department has actually addressed that in some of their guidance, where they say the airline should try to accommodate both people. So, for example, if you board the plane and someone comes on with their emotional support cat and you're allergic, you ought to alert the airline to that, and maybe they can move you to a different part of the plane. But they cannot prohibit the emotional support animal based on an allergy of another passenger.
Interesting. I wonder what you think about that that title or that name, Randy, emotional support animal, given, again, that you've relied on official service animals for a long time.
So I'm totally comfortable with the title. I'm even comfortable with the situation that they're under the duress of a flight and may have need. Where I have problems is with the training, because we actually had a problem come up just over a year ago where emotional support animals had done a few things improper on flights. And so Delta Airlines led the way. Several other airlines came in, and they restricted all animals. And the restrictions they put in for all animals, including service animals, as a result of that, were so prohibitive I couldn't reasonably fly, because if my flight got transferred, I'd be stuck. Right? If I got switched to a different airline because of their requirements. They've since reduced them, but the point is we've got to have a system that can give me the protections because my dog has gone through that training.
Sure, and you can't fly without that dog.
You bet.
Okay, all right. Well, lots more to talk about after a short break. And we'll start taking your calls, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Thanks for those Facebook comments that came in earlier. You can contact us on Facebook. It's NHPR Exchange. More after a short break. We'll be right back.
Thank you. our mission is to support the communities we serve, and that's so aligned to what NHPR does.
Wendy Beswick, Vice President of Marketing for Service Credit Union.
Hampshire Public Radio is all about being in the community, talking to the community, and so we feel like it's just a great place for us to get out in front of people who may not know about the credit union.
Learn more about NHPR's corporate support program at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, service animals, emotional support animals, therapy pets. What are the different roles they serve? And why are we seeing more animals in public places these days? Send us an email. Tell us your stories. exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, lots of listeners jumping into our conversation. Here's an email from Shauna. I have a service dog who is a patient of Dr. Russert's in Keene. There you go, Sabrina. We have definitely felt the effects of people bringing poorly trained dogs into public. Several times just in the past month, there have been dogs in shopping carts that have been lunging, barking, and snarling at my dog. The biggest issue, though, is with businesses not understanding their rights and the things they can ask or when they should ask an animal to leave. Shauna says, a business can ask, is that a service dog? And what task or work has the animal been trained to do? If the animal is disruptive or dangerous, the business can ask that that dog be removed. The problem is they never do. Okay, lots in this email, Shauna. Thank you so much. First to you, Sabrina, since she's clearly a client of yours. But go ahead on her comments on, you know, the way the animals interact with each other.
Absolutely. And I think kind of piggybacking on what Randy was discussing about training, you know, there these programs are in place for a reason, training programs, and a whole host of animals fail out of them during this training process for many reasons. And sometimes it's, you know, I can't focus, and sometimes they're too excitable, sometimes it's aggression. So I think if we kind of take a flip perspective on this, and, you know, we can get very clinical about the benefits that dogs give to humans, you know, anti-anxiety, we're decreasing cortisol, increasing oxytocin. All of this is, you know, really, really great stuff for humans. But what about the dogs and whether or not their welfare is being considered? So, you know, if we come back to aggression in a supermarket or the dog that we heard about that bit somebody on a plane, dogs don't react that way for no reason. They're not just arbitrarily striking out and biting. So they have their own fears. They have their own triggers. And I think that we need to take a perspective about the animals and whether or not they're suitable and whether or not their welfare as an emotional support animal is being considered. Are they appropriate for that task, regardless of how good it makes us feel to have them around?
Oh, I see. So you really need to look at it from multiple perspectives.
Absolutely.
What the person needs, what the animal needs, the abilities of the animal, but also the general public, you know, the other person on the plane or the other person at the grocery store. Randy, what's your perspective on the email that we received from Shauna? Thank you, Shauna.
Sure. So there's a couple of interesting challenges. From a business owner's perspective, one of the challenges they face is even if they are totally justified in asking that person to leave because there's a lot of evidence that it's not an appropriate service animal, they have to face the court of public opinion. And oftentimes that person who leaves is not going to say, oh, right, you caught me, my bad. They're going to say, this is the indignity that happened to me. This was my service animal, even though it wasn't, even though they know they're misrepresenting. And the public isn't going to know the story. They're going to hear and react. And that business can't necessarily afford the bad PR. So what they often invoke is the behavioral aspect of it, which we like to call the toddler rule. You should never be able to ask any animal to leave, a service animal, emotional support, any, you know, any of them, unless you would also ask a toddler to have to leave a restaurant for it, right?
It's interesting what Shauna says, you know, that, and you touched on this, Randy, that businesses do have the right to ask those two questions, but often they don't because of the court of public opinion. People get out their smartphones and they film these interactions, and maybe the business is in the right, but it doesn't look good. And animals are cute, and, you know, dogs and cats and so forth. So I wonder what you think about this. Lynn, what rights, you said this earlier, but what rights specifically does a business have with emotional support animals? If I run a restaurant and somebody brings in a big old dog and some of my customers look a little bit upset about that, what rights do I have as that restaurant owner?
Well, Well, I think it's really important to make that distinction between service animals and emotional support animals. Emotional support animals are not allowed in restaurants.
They are on airplanes, though.
They are on airplanes, but they are not allowed in restaurants and stores. Now, we also need to make a distinction between psychiatric service animals and emotional support animals. And a psychiatric service animal is a service animal if the dog has received training and it provides some task or it does some service for the individual who has a psychiatric disability. But an emotional support animal, it would not be enough. You know, you go out and you get yourself a cat and you want it to come live with you in your apartment and it's going to provide you with some emotional support, that's great. And you can have that in housing under the Fair Housing Act as an accommodation, even if your landlord has a no pet policy.
Wow.
But you can't then take your cat who just provides emotional support and bring him into the grocery store or the movie theater or a restaurant because that animal is not a service animal. But there are psychiatric service animals who are trained and do perform tasks for individuals with psychiatric disabilities.
Wow. So it's a little confusing. And you're doing a great job explaining it. So an emotional support animal, again, that's not as official as psychiatric service animal or service animal. But it seems like you're saying, Lynn, you have the right to have them in a no pets housing complex. You have the right to bring an emotional support animal on a plane, but you don't have specific rights in other places, you know, nightclubs, restaurants,
grocery stores,
and so forth. Okay, so it's a little confusing. Now, what about psychiatric service animals?
Psychiatric service animals are permitted in places like restaurants, hotels, shopping malls, supermarkets.
Anywhere where Randy's dog would be
allowed.
That is
correct.
Wow. Okay. And Sabrina, you told us earlier, though, that you don't, as a veterinarian, certify psychiatric service animals. Again, that's a relationship. That's about the person. That's not about the
correct.
Dog or,
yeah,
or
and
whatever.
I think that, you know, that kind of grays the waters for us because we do have, you know, a lot of non-visible disabilities. We've got people who have post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, there's all sorts of mental health issues that could really benefit from a psychiatric service dog. But again, the question needs to become what specific task has that animal been trained to provide you? And if we're not seeing a visible disability, then I think businesses and, you know, private landlords start to err on the side of caution and don't want to ask too many questions and find out where the line between emotional and psychiatric lies with an individual.
And I did want to let people know we did reach out to the New Hampshire Psychiatric Association to get them involved in this part of our discussion. They declined to provide someone to talk to us about that. So because that is part of this whole process. I love your thoughts, too, though, Lindsay, on this. I mean, you train service dogs. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the sort of gaping hole here is the emotional support animal category. And part of that is just that it's a newer category. It's a newer program and concept that has so many beautiful benefits when it's done right. But these are animals that are really providing that support within a home environment. And many of us have had pets who are wonderful in our own homes but aren't appropriate to be walking through the supermarket or who I wouldn't take to PetSmart. So because emotional support animals are not getting any formal training or are not required to have formal training, they may be very well behaved or they may have a variety of challenges when they go out into the public. And I think, again, until we address the almost complete lack of pet-friendly housing, not just in the state of New Hampshire, but around the country, people will continue to exploit categories like the emotional support animal piece so they can get into housing that allows them to keep their pets. And so this is very much a holistic issue that needs to be addressed from a variety of different ways.
Okay, and I misspoke. I meant to say the New Hampshire Psychological Association, not the Psychiatric Association. So correction there. Lots of people, again, joining us with their comments and thoughts. Let's take some calls. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. And Alex is calling in from Rochester. Hi, Alex. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
We sure can. Go ahead, Alex.
Yes. I myself am a resident of New Hampshire, and I have a disability in the form of a mental illness. And I'm aware of an organization called the Disability Rights Center in Concord, New Hampshire, which does have a flyer specifically about, it's called Emotional Support Animals in quote-unquote No Pet Housing. I want to get a cat, and I'm on a fixed income, like roughly $800 a month. And, you know, my rent is partially subsidized. That's how I survive. But my landlord requires a $400 pet deposit.
Oh, wow.
I can't afford that. That's just, to me, that's an obstacle, a financial obstacle as a person with a disability to having an emotional support animal. But the Disability Rights Center does have a flyer, and I'm looking at it on my smartphone. So people with disabilities like myself can have access to this information if they contact the Disability Rights Center requesting this flyer as to how to get a legal waiver, so to speak.
That's the best way to put it. Well, Alex, thank you for calling in. And we've got Lynn Clay from the Disability Rights Center right here in studio. So go ahead, Lynn, please.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And the answer to that is that if the animal is an emotional support animal, then the pet fee is waived. You cannot charge a surcharge for a person having an emotional support animal, and we have successfully advocated for landlords to waive that fee.
It's interesting, you know, this comes up so often in our society. We talk about rights, and then we talk about the person on the other side and their rights. I mentioned my cousin earlier who's highly, highly allergic. What about the rights, Lynn, of the landlord who... You know, cats, for example, as they get older, they lose certain functions and, you know, they can stink up the carpet. I mean, I just wonder, you know, what rights those business people have to keep their housing in acceptable condition.
Sure. Just as with a hotel or in housing, if an animal does damage, then you can charge the person for that.
And that's after why the fact.
That's why you have a security deposit. And whether the person or their children or the emotional support animal causes damage to the apartment, the landlord has recourse to recoup that loss.
So I see. So after the fact, but don't go into it assuming there's going to be a problem and charging people like Alex extra for that.
That's correct.
Anybody else want to jump in on that issue? Lindsay?
I would just say that you know, I've been a renter for most of my adult life, and I always have pets that I need to find housing with. And it is near impossible. In my case, I have two large dogs, so usually there's size restrictions. One of them is a pit bull type dog, which adds another layer of restriction. And then I have a cat. And, you know, my advice to pet owners, whether you're talking emotional support animals or just your average pet owner, is there are ways to work with landlords to get through the fears that many of them have, either because they had a legitimately bad experience in the past or because they're just concerned. And some of those tips are things like create a pet resume for your animal that speaks to all of the skills or training or medical care that they've received. And probably the most important thing you can do is connect your new potential landlord with previous landlords to talk about the experience that they had with you. The rental I ended up in a couple of years ago, the Craigslist post literally said, "No pets, don't ask." And I wrote to them and I said, "This is who I am." And obviously it helps that I'm a professional dog trainer, but I offered everything under the sun and they gave it to me. So, you know, I think both on both sides of this, pet owners need to come to the table with more to offer if possible. And landlords need to come with a bit of a more of an open mind, because your pet owning population is probably going to stay in your rental housing longer because we're so desperate to find a place that we can stay with our animals.
How much do you understand, Lindsay, the concerns of a landlord? You know, dogs and cats and who knows what else can, you know, scratch up the walls, mess with the carpet. You know, that does have a cost associated with it.
Yeah, I think absolutely. And the reason that that particular person had restricted is because the previous tenant had gotten a puppy who had done what puppies do. So I fully understand those issues. But just like we're sort of opposed to any kind of categorical generalizations of people or animals, and pet-owning tenants can be some of your most responsible tenants, and they can also be some of the most difficult ones to deal with. So, you know, I think that there's an opportunity here for everyone to work together. From our perspective, the number one reason the dogs and cats enter our local shelters is because people cannot find a place to live with them. It isn't people who don't care about their animals.
Oh,
quite
really?
The contrary.
They can't find an apartment, and so they have to give up the cat or the
It is the number one reason. And so we're spending all of these resources finding new homes for those pets when all we could have done is found a place for that person to live with them.
Go ahead, Sabrina.
Yeah, and we see, you know, according to our most recent National Pet Ownership Survey, between 62 and 68% of the U.S. population owns animals. You know, many of them are multiple pet households. They've got dogs and cats. So this isn't something that's going away. And in terms of people that have socioeconomic restrictions, you know, most of the time they've got huge benefits from having dogs and cats in their lives and not having, you know, an extensive disposable income for things like a $400 pet deposit does not equate to not loving their animals or not being able to care for them to the extent that they're able to.
Let's go back to our listeners. Thank you, Alex, for that call. And Mary Jane's calling in from Hanover. Hi, Mary Jane. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Hello. Hi. I'm calling today to really honor my dog, who was registered as an emotional support dog. I had to put her. She was euthanized this weekend.
Sorry, Mary Jane.
On January 1st. My husband and I, adopted our Lila. Her name is Lila, and she's a Sheltie, and a beautiful, beautiful Sheltie. Everybody just always would stop me and just tell me how beautiful they, you know, thought she was and everything. She brought a lot of comfort to a lot of people. My husband and I had Lila, and she was very attached to my husband and very attached to me, too. And then my husband passed. He passed about a year later. And then Lila and I, just really reattached.
Wow, Mary Jane, you've had a tough year. So the dog,
yeah.
Mary Jane, was sort of your emotional support after your husband passed away.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, it was just my daughter, you know, lives in Connecticut, and I was by myself. And so I was just talking, you know, I would just talk to Lila, and everywhere I would go, I would take her with me, and I would talk to her in the car, and I would talk to her on walks. You know, it was somebody, not somebody, but something, I guess, that I could interact with.
And Mary Jane, I'm sorry to jump in, but I did want to ask you a question. Did you get Lila certified as an emotional support animal?
Yes, I did. After a couple of years, I noticed that there were all these emotional support animals in a lot of different places that I would go to that I didn't feel comfortable bringing Lila in, you know, stores, grocery stores, restaurants, airplanes. And I thought, well, Mary Jane, you know, if they're bringing their animals in, you could bring Lila, because Lila is, you know, so good. You know, 99% of the time, she was absolutely excellent. 1%, she kind of, you know, could get a little wacky. But 99% of the time, she was perfectly, you know, the best dog ever, very intelligent.
I'm going to let you go, Mary Jane, okay, because we're heading into a break, and I did want to get the thoughts of our panelists. And, Randy, you know, I asked you this before, but, the idea of official service dogs like yours and emotional support dogs like Lila, I just wonder what you think.
So, again, we hear a little bit about education, right? We've heard very clearly that emotional support is not legally protected, not allowed legally to be in restaurants and stores, but the misconceptions that they are. Obviously, Mary Jane heard that other animals were, so she thought she could bring hers. And, you know, you heard the statement, 99% of the time. Well, what if that 1% of the time is when I'm trying to work my guide to get in somewhere, and it's a dangerous point, the top of a staircase at a restaurant or a store? That 1% of the time matters, and there's reasons why those laws exist.
Well, and after a short break, maybe we can talk a little bit more about that. I've heard from other people, Randy, who, you know, if you pay too much attention, and you probably just think my dog is adorable, but if you pay too much attention to my service dog, he or she gets distracted and can't focus on the task that the dog is supposed to help me with. So we'll pick up on that after a short break. And boy, Mary Jane, you've had a tough year. You've got my sympathies. Thank you so much for calling. More of your calls and emails after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Every convention about how true crime stories usually unfold is upended.
That's why Bear Brook, the latest podcast from NHPR, has been downloaded more than a million times.
30 years ago this month, a mystery began.
It's the story of a decades-old cold case that's changing how murders will be investigated forever, reported by NHPR's own Jason Moon.
This story is not going to go the way you think it is.
Download it now or check it out at bearbrookpodcast.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, we're looking at how people, businesses, and others are dealing with a growing population of animals accompanying their owners in public spaces and the expanding number and the expanding role that service animals play in our society. We're hearing about not just traditional seeing eye dogs, as they're often called, but also psychiatric service animals, emotional support animals. And lots of you are joining our conversation. We encourage you to call 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You know, all of you, in advance of the show, we asked for stories of Granite Staters with service dogs, and we heard from Stephanie Verdial. She lives in Gilmanton with Maggio, her German Shepherd service dog. Stephanie trained the dog herself. He helps her with mobility and stability issues. And Stephanie shared some advice, and this picks up on what you said, Randy, before the break, some advice on people who see service dogs, might want to interact with them. Stephanie says, here's please what I don't want you to do.
I think the biggest thing is just please respect the vest and leave them alone, like I said. And I've had both experiences. I've had people who go, oh, look at how pretty he is, and come up and talk right to him. And as soon as someone acknowledges him, he gets very friendly. He's a very well-socialized dog. So as soon as someone looks at him, acknowledges him, puts their hand out to him, it breaks his training. So it interferes. It's extremely detrimental to their training and to their purpose.
So that's what you talked about earlier, Randy, saying when somebody comes up and, you know, loves your dog, wants to interact, or when their own emotional support animal, psychiatric service dog, whatever, doesn't behave properly, it kind of throws you off. You could fall down the stairs.
Sure. And you know, even my dog, I mean, there's times that they're going to get distracted. And your job, you know, she says when somebody comes up to her dog, it can distract them if they put their hand out to them. And we work hard to train our dogs to ignore those distractions. Right. But if somebody holds out a slice of pizza, my dog is going to sniff that. She won't
take it.
But she's going to turn her head. She's going to be aware. Or even just calling their names. You know, a lot of service dog owners will give a fake name because people learn the name and they'll call out to it. Hey, Autumn. And what do you do when you hear your name? You turn your head. And if you turn your head, or if she turns her head when there's a pothole right there, or, you know, that's a stumble for me, or worse, a fall.
I never even thought about that, you know, calling her. I can see holding out the slice of pizza, but I guess if I were in that situation, I should say, hey, Randy, but not call to the dog.
Right. Communication should be with the handler, including, and this is an interesting part of that, you know, sometimes people will ask, you know, can I say hi to your service animal? And there are times that it's absolutely inappropriate. And that can be frustrating how often I get asked, but that's an individual's choice on how they want to handle that. Some people put signs on their service animal. I actually have an off-duty command that I use in the appropriate situation because it lets me build education. And I really believe that education is the key to having better advocacy and better interaction in general.
Okay. Well, let's go right back to our listeners. And Don is calling from Bow. Hi, Don. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Laura. Hello, everybody. I'm a landlord, and my question is, where can we go to verify that it is in fact a service dog or an emotional support dog?
Have you gotten requests, Don, from people who want to rent from you?
In the past, and you just bite the bullet and hope they don't ruin the house or do more damage than their security deposit covers.
Yeah, so you don't want to create a fuss, and you kind of cross your fingers. And that gets to something that Lindsay said earlier, that, you know, businesses can ask those questions, but sometimes they don't want to. What do you think, Lynn?
Well, in the housing context, for a landlord, there is no certification for these animals formally with the state. But for a person who has an emotional support animal, it's going to be sufficient if they provide a letter from their mental health provider that says that the animal is providing emotional support, that the person has a disability. that they require the animal in order to benefit from the housing. So once a person who needs an emotional support animal provides that documentation, that's going to be enough. Now, for other types of service animals, if it's something like a guide dog, it should be fairly obvious what the purpose of the dog is. You probably wouldn't even need to ask for that kind of documentation.
How much cheating do you think goes on, Lynn?
I think that's hard to say, but I also recognize that here in New Hampshire, we have a law that prohibits that. And it is unlawful to fit an animal with a vest or to represent that an animal is a service animal if it's not.
What happens if you do?
It's a misdemeanor.
Okay. Because I know in at least around a dozen states, I think they now impose some pretty hefty fines if you fake it. Go ahead, Randy. You want to jump in there.
Well, you know what? I don't actually think it is obvious that it's a service animal. You know, take the psychiatric. In the case of PTSD, it could be a service animal or it could be an emotional support animal that serves somebody who has PTSD. The difference is it trained to perform an action? But so the service animal variation, you wouldn't have anything different that you would notice necessarily, right? So it's tough to be. I'm just advocating on the landlord's behalf here. How would they know? And I don't have an answer for them. I don't think it's always an obvious answer.
And again, we tried to get a mental health professional to come on and talk about that, but had a hard time doing that. Lynn and then Sabrina.
I agree with you, Randy. Not in all cases are service animals obvious what their function is. And I think if it is obvious, I think landlords should not be intrusive about it. If it is not obvious, then I think they can ask for some form of documentation, usually in the form of a letter from a doctor, to support what the animal does.
Go ahead, Sabrina.
Yeah, and I think piggybacking on this, we're starting to see a huge increase in animals that are attending college campuses along with their humans. If we just did a study of the different vet schools, 28 vet schools that are in the States, 33% of their programs over the past 2 years had requests for emotional service animals. And I think, not just living in dorms, not just the benefit of, how the humans are getting by, but again, is it the best thing for a cat or a guinea pig or a dog to be living under certain circumstances?
So you're asking people to not only look at their own needs, but look at the needs of the animal itself.
From a welfare perspective, yeah.
And again, the college has an interest in keeping the dorms clean and free of fleas or whatever an animal might bring in. And there are other people in that dorm who might be allergic or who might, if a dog isn't well trained, might be barking at night. And so there's all these issues, isn't there? I wonder what you think, Lindsay. I mean, there's so many different concerns once you start to really broaden the pool to emotional support animals.
I think these conversations are how we get to the solution. At the core of this debate is the human-animal bond. And to Sabrina's point, people are going to have pets. And the Humane Society of the United States, we believe very strongly that everyone should have access to pets. This is not something that should be a middle-class privilege to have an animal. And so I think that there's ways to pass certain policies that help landlords feel more comfortable. For example, there's some bills around the country this year that remove liability for property owners for emotional support animals. So if they've done their due diligence, they've asked for that letter from the person's therapist or doctor that it is an emotional service support animal, and then the support animal does do something, bite somebody, or there's a nuisance issue, that the landlord would no longer be liable for those issues. And I think that there's ways to pass policies that protect business owners, landlords, et cetera, without limiting the fact that people want to be with these animals and that they do legitimately provide benefit.
Everyone, as you said, should have the right to a pet, Lindsay, regardless of their own income. But other people who don't want to be around pets kind of have those rights, too. I guess that's what I'm trying to inject in the conversation, is that there are people who are really uncomfortable around animals or are allergic. So
absolutely. And I think that the nonprofit community, hopefully at some point, the states will sort of step in to provide as much support as possible so that these animals are appropriate. Really, one of the answers to this issue is that emotional support animals, because they're not receiving any formal training in most capacities, the behavior and training world can step in and say, we're going to provide some services here. And there are organizations, including right here in New Hampshire, like Pets for Vets, which helps to select appropriate homeless dogs to pair with veterans who are looking for an emotional support animal. So there's sort of a middle person who's trying to vet the animal and make sure they're a little bit more appropriate to be in public spaces.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. We got an email from Ashley who says there is no organization, especially online, that legally certifies service or emotional support animals. Trainers, Ashley says, may, quote, certify dogs as service or ESA, but there is no legal organization that regulates such. Is that right, Lynn?
That is true.
Randy, you're nodding too. Yeah. So it's kind of the Wild West, right? There's no sort of state or federal agency that says this is okay and this is not.
Yeah, that's correct.
I'm surprised by that, Randy.
So the ADA protects the service animal if it meets those two requirements. You know, we heard from the person you interviewed yesterday. She trained her own service animal, right? So what kind of training did it go through? Whatever amount she put it through. Was it a week program? Was it 18 months? Right? I mean, there's no requirement. That's the unfortunate reality. And I say unfortunate because it means that in some situations, an animal may not be appropriate for the task it's doing, may not be comfortable with the environment, to Sabrina's points. And those may actually not even be doing the service to the way they best could for the person who may have need.
Well, here's an email from Marguerite who says, last year at the Orlando, Florida airport, a woman traveling with a support squirrel was taken off the plane and caused a 2-hour delay for that flight. And of course, we've all seen stories on social media about support pigs and support peacock, I think I saw. And I think if someone sat next to a relative of mine with a support snake, she would freak out. So there are those stories out there. Do you think there's a need, Randy, for more rigor in this area, getting to Ashley's point that there's really no official certification or regulation process?
So I actually do. The ADA restricts it to dogs only, which is kind of an interesting choice that they made probably in 2012, I think. But that doesn't hold to other, like to the Airline Carrier Access Act. That does not hold to that, right? So nor to the emotional support animal. But I think regulation is needed to make sure that all animals are going to be appropriate out there. The challenge is then, how do you enforce? How do you regulate?
Squirrels and peacocks and dogs. What do you think, Lindsay? Do we need a little more rigor in this realm of emotional support animals, psychiatric support animals, service animals, and so forth?
I think we're going to see more policies about this category, and it is needed. What our concern is at the Humane Society is that the knee-jerk reaction when something bad happens is usually a policy that's completely ineffective. And last summer, we were very disappointed that Delta Airlines, when they had a few issues, they decided to ban pit bull-type dogs from the planes, which, whether you're talking about breed-specific legislation on the state or local level or on an airline, research has shown time and time again that it does nothing to improve public safety. What we'd rather see is the airlines or property owners or others making their determinations based on the behavior of the individual animal.
Yeah, but sometimes you don't know if it's going to be bad behavior until it's too late.
And I think that's where the oversight and whether it's policy-based or whether it's vetting of organizations that are training these animals, that there is sort of a broader process to ensure that they're acceptable to be in the public spaces.
So agreeing with Randy, in a way, if there were more rigor, it would make things easier for everyone because everyone would be able to trust that, oh, this comes from official agency or organization. It doesn't come from, you know, online bogus certification and so forth. Go ahead, Randy.
So just as you mentioned, though, the knee-jerk reaction is what I fear as well. So in my case, there are guide schools that make sure there are animals that are well-trained, but there are some disabilities for which the cost for getting an animal to do those tasks is so prohibitive that they need a different means. And if you're going to make those people go through a rigorous process, they may not be able to afford a service animal for the very real need they have. So how we invoke those processes is important. It has to be done with the right people at the table to make those decisions.
Do you want to jump in, Lynn, on the idea that it's kind of the Wild West and maybe a little more official certification would be helpful?
Well, I'm not sure. I think I agree more with Randy's point that, you know, you have to be careful that you don't put in place a process that then makes these animals unavailable to people who really need them.
We heard earlier from Alex who couldn't afford to pay the $400. Go ahead.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think for a lot of people with disabilities, it would become prohibitively expensive if we had that process in place. I did want to go back to what you were saying about the airlines and the Air Carrier Access Act. There are some restrictions. They don't restrict it to just cats and dogs, and so that is why you do see some of these stories about other animals. The transportation department has said snakes are not allowed, so your family member who's afraid of snakes can rest assured.
Rest easy if she's listening.
But in terms of other animals, the airlines are supposed to make a case-by-case assessment of the animal, and animals that are too large or going to cause a disruption of the flight would not be allowed in the air cabin.
Let's try and take one more call if we could. And this is Amy and Keene. Hi, Amy. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome. Okay, Amy. Sorry about that. Let's see if there's Carol in Londonderry. Hi, Carol. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. My question is, to follow up from an earlier caller, many people with disabilities are on limited resources for their living expenses. Are there programs in New Hampshire for these individuals to help with their well child visits for their service animals? Because it can be quite costly to be a pet owner.
Oh, you know, and thank you for the call, Carol. We've done shows on this, Sabrina. I think you were on one of them, the costs of veterinary care. I mean, if you have a service animal like Randy or one of the psychiatric service animals that we've talked about, do you get a benefit or some help paying the cost if you can't afford it?
You know, officially, I think on a professional level, no, there's not anything that's in place. I know many practices that offer discounts for, you know, service animals, verifiable service animals, you know, veterans, people who need these kind of dogs. So it's really on an individual, you know, practice by practice basis. But I really think that kind of speaks to a larger issue here, from my perspective at least, is that these dogs or cats that are coming in as ESAs, they're not just, you know, a modality to a mental health treatment plan. They're sentient creatures that need health. They need welfare concerns. They need, you know, veterinary care. And, you know, I would never suggest that people on fixed incomes shouldn't have animals. I think the opposite. I think they, you know, bring great, great benefits to people's lives. But moving into that, you have to, you know, anticipate providing for their health and welfare.
So if an emotional support animal is really seen as someone that something that helps somebody stay stable, or a psychiatric service animal, you know, helps someone detect whether they're going to have a PTSD reaction or something. It's tricky, isn't it? Because it's almost like medicine for some people, but it also costs money.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
Anything, Sabrina, you want to leave our audience with as a veterinarian on this issue?
You know, I just think that, again, we need to kind of keep in mind the dog and the cat's perspective here. Are they the ones that are appropriate for these tasks? And are they comfortable in public spaces? Are they comfortable doing the jobs that we want them to do?
Yeah, spoken as a veterinarian. Randy, how about you? Any just quick final thoughts you want to leave our audience with?
I think like everything, the more open our minds are to learning and thinking, the easier all of us are at getting to the real resolutions of problems. And we're still on that journey.
All right. Well, it was really great to have all of you here. We could have talked a lot longer. Randy, it was nice to meet you. Thank you so much. That's Randy Pierce. He's president of 2020 Vision Quest. His guide dog, by the way, is with us in the studio as well. Lindsay Hamrick, thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it. Lindsay Hamrick, New Hampshire State Director for the Humane Society of the U.S. Lynn Clay, thank you for making the trip.
Thank you.
That's Lynn Clay, Managing Attorney at the Disability Rights Center of New Hampshire. And Sabrina, thank you for coming over from Keene. We appreciate it. That's Sabrina Estabrook-Russett. She's a veterinarian owner of Court Street Veterinary Hospital in Keene. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.